Thank you. Good morning. This is case 823-1979, if I pronounce this correctly, Judah versus Hudani Jinje. As all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for respondent will have 15 minutes, and then there'll be 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is being both live streamed, and there'll be a permanent audio recording available tomorrow, but our rules do prohibit anyone from making their own private recording, so please respect that. Counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, just tell us who you are and in a loud, clear voice, and you may begin. Oh, I'm sorry. There you go. I'm the one who's incompetent technologically today. Thank you so much, Judge Cochran and Sue. So, Mr. Dieveley, just tell us who you are in a loud voice, and you may begin, sir.
Yes, good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Gary Diebele, and I represent appellant Dr. Jacob Judah in this matter. And I would reserve 5 minutes for my reply. So thank you. Well, this is a marriage dissolution appeal, Your Honors. Rather straightforward one at that, I believe. Basically, we have three issues that we're going to be talking about this morning. First would be a review of the spousal maintenance decision by the lower court. Second would be a determination regarding a non-marital property classification and treatment in the divorce proceeding. And then third, the issue of an award of need-based attorney's fees. There was also a motion filed subsequently for pre-decision attorney's fees on appeal, and I'll address that issue with the context of the whole attorney's fee issue when I get to the third argument. All three of these issues are being reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard of review. So there's no complex issues regarding what standard of review we're under. So hopefully that'll keep us focused in that regard. Just let me give very briefly background to set the context for this. So both of these parties are originally from Nigeria. They're both very accomplished in their careers. Dr. Judah, my client, is a surgeon at the Olmsted County Medical Center in Rochester, and Miss Achebe is a nurse. She's actually got 3 degrees, possibly four. She's an LPN, an RN. She's got a bachelor's of science in nursing. And at least at the time of trial, she was working on a doctorate in nursing practice. I don't know if she's completed that or not. Folks were married a little under 10 years. They were together about 7 years. I was not the trial attorney on this, but having reviewed the transcript, it was a rather acrimonious divorce, went on over a period of 10 days. And the court issued its initial findings of fact, conclusions of law and order for divorce on August 7th of 2023. So following about a nine and a half year marriage. Parties have 3 children, ages 7, 5, and 4. During the marriage, while they were here in the United States, Dr. Judah was the primary financial support for the family while Ms. Achebe was in school and caring for the children. Parties eventually moved to Rochester, and the respondent continued on with her education, working part-time, going to school, and raising the children. And the parties then subsequently filed for this divorce. And as I indicated, the divorce decree was issued in August of 2023. There were motions filed immediately after the divorce decree was entered, one, a motion to correct clerical mistakes filed by the appellant, and then a motion for amended findings filed at the same time by the appellant. Those are somewhat relevant because I think respondent's attorney is raising some questions about whether issues were properly preserved for the appeal. So I'll address those kind of in the context of my remarks. In terms of some of the financial background, the respondent was awarded $8,000 a month in temporary spousal maintenance for a period of 2 years. There was a property settlement that she received of approximately $355,000. In addition to half of the appellant's retirement fund. And then she was awarded $120,000 in need-based fees, and child support was set at just under $4,000 a month. So I'll start with the spousal maintenance award. And again, it was $8,000 a month for 2 years. Our position on this is really there's no basis for an award of spousal maintenance in this case. And I think if you just start with the bare arithmetic on it, and I'll get into some of the legal concerns we have about that spousal maintenance award in a minute. But basically what the court found was that the respondent was unemployed at the time of the divorce trial. She had an ability to earn $1,375.64 gross per month, was the finding of the court, which we disagree with and think the record supports a much higher ability to earn income, but that was her finding at the time of trial. The court made findings of the respondent's monthly living expenses, found them to be $6,887 per month, down from about $15,000 that she claimed in the course of the trial. And our position would be that even if the respondent worked part-time during, right after the divorce or even during the divorce, she was earning between $35 and $50 an hour throughout the marriage, over a number of different jobs that she had while she was going to school. And if we use that hourly wage of $35 to $40 an hour, even working part-time, she could be generating between $6,000 and $8,000 a month in gross income. That coupled with the child support would simply indicate arithmetically that there was no need for spousal maintenance. And so that's the first concern we have. Also, we're concerned that there were not a lot of the findings of fact that are necessary, the statutory findings that need to be made for spousal maintenance were not
counsel,
done. Yes.
Your argument that when you look at the amount that the court said she was able to earn, that it, and you look at her monthly budget, that she doesn't need $8,000 a month. But isn't that kind of conflating the subdivision one and subdivision two of the maintenance statute? I mean, isn't the first question whether there's a need at all for any support? And the second question is what the amount and duration? And
Right.
so in terms of determining the need, isn't it appropriate to look at her earning ability versus her monthly budget? And then, I mean, I think respondent has a view about whether the monthly budget should be used or some higher number. But anyway, assuming you take the monthly budget and the 1,300 $75 that the district court found per month, there is a need there if you accept the $1,375 per month, correct?
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. And I think we do have to focus on that first prong of whether there's a need. And inherent with figuring out whether there is a need is what is the party's actual income as the court is making this decision. And then also looking at, are they earning as much as they possibly can. I mean, it's not unusual where the court says, your choice if you don't want to work full time or don't want to work at all, but based on your employment history, your educational background, all those are relevant in that first prong of the statute. And that's really the crux of our argument, I think, on the spousal maintenance, is that I don't think the court did a careful enough analysis on that first prong to really get to, was there a need?
Counsel, there are copious findings that the district court made, not just about her ability to pay, but all of the circumstances bringing her to the place that she's in now. For example, that your client refused to pay for any of her educational advancements, and that forced her into debt, that she's unable to pay for her rent and is taking out loans, that her continued education over the next 2 years are going to require her to incur substantial additional debt. To be generous, the way that you're characterizing these findings by the district court as not considering her circumstances fairly, it seems inaccurate.
Well, Your Honor, I think that gets to actually the second argument that we make on the spousal maintenance. I don't dispute for a minute that the findings aren't copious and detailed. I mean, there are pages and pages of them. But one of the things that a court is clearly not to do, and this goes back to the Gales case that the Minnesota Supreme Court handed down in 1996, and the Martini case that came down after that, is the court is not to consider misconduct in determining maintenance. Because you can imagine, we would always be dealing with maintenance cases of people could say, here's all the horrible things my spouse did to me.
Which one of the district court's findings, I have the order right in front of me, show me where the district court used misconduct in calculating the maintenance award.
Well,
findings are you referencing?
I'm not referencing a specific. I mean, there were several findings that we raised throughout the brief about claims that my client tried to run her over in the parking lot, claims that he cut her off of medical records. Those were kind of the two most glaring examples. But then I think there's also claims, you know, the underlying assumption under these findings is that he wasn't a nice person. He wasn't treating her properly. He was making things difficult for her. And, you know, I think one of the things that probably is underlying this, and I don't think the court, I don't recall any findings on this, was that there was some cultural assumptions going on with these folks about what would be. My client took a very traditional view that when they came to the United States, she was going to stay home and take care of the kids. She'd go back to school to learn music, and she would be the primary caretaker. She had different ideas. You know, that certainly is fine. She wanted to be have a career in a medically related field, and so she did that. So I think there was a lot of a lack of connection between the two in terms of life goals. And I think that's where I think the court makes these findings about, well, he wouldn't support her in her educational path. He cut her off of this. That's where I think we veer into this idea about, do we focus on how these parties got to the circumstances that they're in, or do we just focus on they're here now? I mean, if the court had said she's incurred debt, make a finding on the debt and make a finding as to how the spousal maintenance is going to relate to paying that off. I don't see this though as I think it's veering more into the misconduct that she was unhappy, perhaps justifiably so, with actions that had been taken. But I
Mr.
think
Dinklage,
that
I was
goes.
wondering, you have other issues, and if you
Judge Connolly, you seem to be frozen. Can we stop? Can we have the marshal stop the clock here for one moment, please? Thank you. Thank you.
I think he might be suggesting that I should move on. Was
No,
that what?
counsel, I'm just going to have you wait and we'll
Okay.
get Judge Connolly back. We'll have him
Okay.
restart his computer and we'll just pause and give you a little bit more time. All right. Thank you for your patience.
Sure.
Well, I apologize. Apparently, I'm back. So,
Judge Connolly, I did ask the marshal to pause the clock, but I think we maybe should add 30 seconds back
yes.
to.
Actually, let's just be fair. And I mean, again, I apologize. I'm not going to go into this, but it is not my fault. Would you put a minute back on the clock, please? And then, yes, thank you. And then my question was to sort of shift to the non-marital property issue and again, try to explain to me the tracing issue. I didn't really follow that, please.
I'd be happy to do that, Your Honor. So that issue is basically there's about a $72,000 dispute as to what should have been characterized as non-marital. And I'll be honest, it's not the strongest non-marital claim that one could make. It's a little bit convoluted because it rests on some bank statements as well as testimony. And the trial court judge didn't find either of those evidentiary supports to be particularly persuasive. So the way it starts is the appellant had sold a piece of property, a home,
The district
before.
court didn't discredited the testimony and the evidence. Is that right?
Yes, did
Okay.
discredit. And basically, it was sold prior to the marriage, and the money was deposited into a separate bank account, this Bank of the West, I believe it was called. And what then happens is where things got complicated is during the marriage, there were several marital accounts that were opened up. And the parties would then put marital monies into those accounts and used it as their cash flow. And at some point during the course of the marriage, the appellant transferred that $72,000 into those joint bank accounts that were created after the marriage. And those accounts were actively used during the marriage. And then at the time of trial, or shortly, I guess it was after the date of valuation was set, but before the trial was fully resolved, he moved out money from that joint bank account into a separate account. And it was a sum that was in excess of the $72,000 amount. And so his argument was that, okay, when we're dividing that account and it's both a marital and a non, has both marital and non-marital components to it, you should take the non-marital off the top, which would be the 72,000, and then what is left would be the marital amount. And the judge in her findings did not, she was not persuaded that there had been too much intermingling of the funds to do that. And what we've argued in our appellate brief is, you know, these don't have to be pristine claims. You have to have some evidence, either testimonial or documentary, to show how you connect it back to the original non-marital amount. And the operative documentary evidence is that exhibits 2 QRST, which are those bank statements. And our view is, if you look at the bank statements, you'll see that original non-marital amount in 2Q, which was that Bank of the West. And then those subsequent statements indicate the transactions that happened short of that, or after that, in the course of the marriage, and then what was left at the time of trial. And our position is simply that he should have been given credit for that $72,000 non-marital claim. And if you subtract that off, then it reduces the property settlement to about $322,000 from $355,000. So I think it comes down to the three of you as the appellate judges having to look at those exhibits and seeing if you agree that whether it was an abuse of discretion for the court to deny that analysis and that claim. Again,
so can I ask a? Oh, go ahead, Judge Cochran.
You would agree that we defer to the district court's credibility determination and we don't reweigh the evidence. And
oh, yes.
I think, found that there wasn't sufficient support to determine that the funds were, in fact, where the funds came from that were in that account. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, Your Honor. And there is a finer, I acknowledged at the beginning that we're under the abuse of discretion standard throughout this case. And so clearly, you know, you do have to give deference to the trial court judge's credibility determinations. And I think what I would, the gloss I would add to that for this particular issue is that because there is some documentary evidence, I think you have the right to look at that and see if you find it was not as clear as we believe it was. I think that first exhibit shows it was money in that account prior to the marriage. I'm not sure what the judge's why she said there was no proof of that, but that's what it goes back
counsel,
to.
Counsel, you just have a short amount of time. I have a question about the response to the petition or to the respondent's fee request. One of the claims that you make is that counsel's fee of $370 per hour and her paralegal's fee of $120 per hour are not reasonable. Can you tell me what your hourly rate is, counsel?
Yes, $550, Your Honor.
All right. And what is your paralegal's hourly rate?
$220, I think. And
is
I
there
think,
some...
Your Honor, the point we made on that was that it was, usually you set those out in your fee affidavit and say, here's what my rates are. And in the community where I practice, this is what it would entail.
I understand.
That was not the focus of our argument, by the way, but that is certainly a point well made. I'll
right,
address
the
attorney's fee issues further in my reply time, if I might.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Mr. Dibley. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you. My name is Danielle DiFiore, and I represent the respondent, Houdani Akinje. I was also the trial attorney in this case, so I'm very familiar with the record. This has been a long case. The dissolution commenced in August of 2021, and it's been plagued with litigation and conflict. In the spring of 2023, there was an 11-day trial that was held over 9 weeks. The court heard testimony of 13 witnesses, including the parties. There were 154 exhibits, 184 findings, and a 64-page order. This case has been plagued with conflict and litigation. Almost all of which has been initiated by Dr. Judah. I'm sorry? I hope it's clear to the appellate court that Dr. Judah is asking this court to reweigh evidence in the record and make credibility determinations that support his positions. It is for the finder of fact to make credibility determinations. The district court repeatedly found Dr. Judah's testimony not to be credible. He's relitigating his same positions or coming up with entirely new theories about alleged errors that the district court made. When reviewing spousal maintenance, there are three questions to ask. Are the findings supported by the record? Has there been a misapplication of the law? And are any district court findings contrary to law or facts on the record? Here, the appellant is arguing about factual disputes and not legal error. There is a clear showing of need. A party is in need of considering the standard of living during the marriage. The party is unable to provide for his or her reasonable expenses through employment income or investment income or a combination of both. The court imputed $1,375 per month to my client as her income. At the time of trial, she was unemployed and she was a full-time student. The court heard testimony from her doctoral nursing program director corroborating that she will not be able to work full-time or even part-time because of the clinical hours that she will have to complete in the last 2 years of her program. So she won't even be able to work at the same levels that she did historically. And the court did make findings about her historic earnings. And they made findings about her budget. And it's common for maintenance seeking spouses to have uncertainty about their future budget as they don't know what their cash flow is going to be. So on the record, my client testified that she's living in a small three-bedroom townhouse, whereas Dr. Judah is living in a nearly million-dollar home. And that's the standard of living that was during the marriage. And she was not living anywhere close to that standard. And so the findings about the budget were about her current expenses, but she testified about how her expenses will increase because she wants to buy a house.
Can you address, I mean, one of the arguments that Mr. Judah makes is that she should use or whittle down her property settlement in order to cover her living expenses. Do you want to address that, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. A maintenance-seeking spouse cannot be required to invade the principal of a property settlement to meet monthly living expenses. This has been held in Curtis. So she's not awarded any assets that are income generating or, you know, or will give her cash in any way.
Counsel, I'm going to stop you. I think we lost Judge Connolly again. I'll have you stop the clock. The marshal stop the clock again. Sue, can you? Thank you. I'm so sorry, counsel. I apologize for interrupting you again. I just want to make sure that Judge Connolly can hear your answer as well. Judge Connolly, just to let you know, I did stop the clock again, but I do think we need to add some time.
Yes. Looks like we were at 11 minutes. Let's add 2 minutes back, please. I apologize once again. I'm in my office and I don't know. So, all right, then, counsel for the respondent, if you could continue your argument, please.
So a maintenance-seeking spouse cannot be required to invade the principal of a property settlement to meet monthly living expenses, which is being proposed in this appeal. My client is entitled to an equalization payment, but none of her assets are income generating, so she shouldn't be required to tap into her equalization payment to meet her monthly living expenses. Additionally, she shouldn't be expected to use child support to meet her monthly living expenses. Child support should not be included in her income when it comes to maintenance, as it's for the benefit of the children, not for her. Maintenance is about maintaining her standard of living at an approximate level as it was in the marriage. And that is the reason that she was awarded maintenance in this case. Additionally, she was unemployed at the time of the trial. There's testimony that she would be employable in 2 years, and the court set a duration of 2 years for maintenance. And the marital misconduct argument, this is the first time that's being raised. Dr. Judah has been arguing that my client does not have a need and has an ability to earn repeatedly throughout the many, many motion hearings that we've had in this case. However, marital misconduct has never been addressed until this appeal. And the court made findings about credibility, not about marital misconduct. There are many findings supporting award of spousal maintenance here. The court issued a thoughtful decision. Turning to the non-marital tracing.
Can I ask you a question about spousal maintenance before you turn to the next issue? It appears that the district court estimated her monthly income based on what one could earn at the minimum wage working 30 hours a week. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, and the statute's cited after it.
Right. So was it an abuse of discretion to rely on the minimum wage where there was evidence in the record as to the hourly wage that she had been making in her various professional nursing related roles?
Well, she was completing practicum requirements and the court made findings about her historic employment. So her hours increased during this dissolution because Dr. Judah was not giving her any financial support from August of 21 until January of 22. And she was delayed in school because she started in January instead of September. So these historic quote unquote earnings are higher because of issues related to this dissolution. Prior to this, she worked very part-time, and the court made findings about that.
But I'm asking
She did
about
not
the
have.
hourly rate, not the total earnings amount. It appears that the hourly rate that she made in the past is higher than the minimum wage.
That's accurate. But
So
it's
should
with.
the district court have used an hourly rate similar to that which she actually made, or was it appropriate? Was it an abuse of discretion to use the minimum wage when there was evidence as to the hourly rate that she had been making in the past?
No, it's not an abuse of discretion because she's also not working because she's in school and completing clinicals. So she used the child support statute, so minimum wage times 30 hours, and that's what was imputed. They argued earning potential, and the court did not find that she has an earning potential of $35 to $50 an hour based on her historic earnings. So no, it was not an abuse of discretion to use minimum wage.
Thank you.
Turning to the non-marital tracing, so Dr. Judah presented a Bank of the West statement from October of 2024. It was incomplete. It just had a balance highlighted. And then the next exhibit was a statement from, I believe it was September of 2015. There weren't any statements in between August of 2014 and September of 2015. So there is nothing there showing if money was going in and out of that account or where the money came from. Dr. Judah didn't raise a non-marital claim until our pretrial in November. He didn't disclose these bank accounts until the pretrial. The court let them in, but they were not disclosed until then. So he has the two statements, one from 2014, one to 2015, and then a transfer of 70,000 and a transfer, I believe, of 7,000 to Bank of America. And Dr. Judah testified that he put money in and out of that Bank of the West account between 2014 and 2015 when he transferred it over to Bank of America. So he did not provide any proof with where the money came from. He did not raise this issue until the pretrial, and is for the court to determine whether or not his testimony was credible. And here the court said that his testimony was not credible when it came to its non-marital claim. Again, this is another thing that was appropriate for the district court, not the appellate court. Dr. Judah is trying to have you reweigh evidence and come out with a different outcome that supports his positions. As far as the attorney's fees are concerned, attorney's fees are awarded need-based when they're necessary for the good faith assertion of the party's rights in this proceeding and will not contribute unnecessarily to the length and expense of the proceeding. And the party from who the fees, costs, and disbursements are sought has the means to pay them. And that the party whom fees, costs, and disbursements are awarded does not have the means to pay them. The court made detailed findings on my client's inability to pay for attorney's fees. At the time of trial, I believe there were $140,000, and she got awarded $120,000 in fees. She had to take out loans to try to pay them when she could. She still has a substantial balance. Dr. Judah has not paid those attorney fee awards. And the court also found that her income alone doesn't meet her expenses, and it certainly does not leave room to pay her attorney's fees. This has been a very expensive and long trial. This trial was delayed, and due to Dr. Judah, I think he had nine attorneys at this point, different attorneys. So all these continued delays have contributed to my client's fees. And the court's not required to make specific findings of good faith as it pertains to each and every hearing or each and every event. This court was familiar with the record as a whole and found that she made a good faith assertion of her rights in this case, and these attorney's fees were necessary for that. She did not contribute unnecessarily to the length of expense of this proceeding. And the court, again, made enumerated findings on that. And I did ask for attorney's fees on appeal, and my hourly rate is $375. My paralegals is $120. We don't bill separately for different attorney time. We bill at the same rate, $375, for all of the attorneys in our office working on this case. So these were reasonable month. This is a reasonable hourly rate. It's significantly lower than Mr. Deebly's. And my client, again, is not working. She doesn't have the means to pay. Also, everything's stayed right now. So she's living off of child support and now working part-time in addition to clinical hours to try to make ends meet. This is
Can I
very
just ask?
complicated.
Can I just ask, with respect to the request for attorney fees on appeal, the motion that's currently pending before us, I take it that's an interim request and there will be an additional request after the conclusion of the appeal. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right.
So again, this is just another redo. That's what this appeal is. Dr. Jude is asking you to reweigh evidence to undermine the finder of fact, which is the district court. This was a very long trial, very detailed. The court made thoughtful findings. There's over 100 exhibits. This is an abuse of discretion standard and the court should uphold the order. So unless you have any other questions, I don't have anything else.
Thank you. I don't believe we do. Mr. Diebel, you'll have the last word, sir.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. And I'll stay focused on the attorney's fees because they didn't capture some of the other issues that were raised in Ms. DeFore's argument. So again, our attorney's fee challenge is based primarily on this issue of whether the respondent actually has the means to pay her own fees through a combination of work, through a combination of using her property settlement if she chooses to, or however else she wants to do it.
Counsel, she can't even pay for school. I mean, she's $27,000 in debt on school. She can't pay for her rent. I mean, I don't know how it's an abuse of discretion for the district court to say she can't pay $180,000 in attorney fees when she can't even afford her current situation.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think if you look at can she not afford her current situation? That's the question.
Well, those were the findings of the district court, and I haven't heard an argument that that's an abuse of discretion yet.
Well, the respondent has 3 degrees. She was making significant amounts of money. This idea that she's going back to get a PhD in nursing is, in my view, and I think a rational person looking at this saying, is that necessary and justified? And should that be a basis then to support these findings by the court that she can't work? Ms. DeFore says she's unemployed. Well, her track record throughout the marriage was she worked and parented the kids full time. Now the parties share joint legal.
Well, you know, Mr. Deeply, on that point, I thought the track record was a little mixed. I mean, I thought she had to leave several of the jobs because of childcare issues. So am I wrong? Is that incorrect?
No, there were findings to that effect. But again, that was before the final order came down. And now my client is responsible for the kids half time. So that should improve her ability to work, in my mind. And if she wants to get a PhD in nursing, fine. That's what opens the door, I think, to looking to her to use some of her property settlement to pay these fees. She's optionally going to school. She wouldn't have to. She could be earning a substantial income as she did before. And that's her choice. And maybe she wants to use some of these, the property settlement to pay fees so that she can go to school. But the point of the matter is that I don't think it's appropriate to then put attorney's fees of this magnitude on my client to support this, what she's planning to do when she's got other options and a history of having contributed and earned good money when she could. And I think these findings as to her not having any income at the time of the divorce are not accurate, not supported by the history and the evidence. You know, again, she made choices just like he made choices. And I don't think there's a basis if you look at what her earning ability is. I think Judge Cochran made a good point when she asked about imputing minimum wage to this respondent. Is that appropriate? She was making up to $50 an hour while she was going to school. She's highly skilled, highly trained. She's in Rochester where she can find all sorts of jobs. And again, I don't have it's not my place to tell her whether she should get a PhD or not, nor is it the court's place to tell her that. That's her choice.
Case law that suggests that the district court abuses its discretion if it doesn't require her to use her property settlement to pay the attorney's fees? I'm not aware of any legal.
No, I think that again is probably an interpretation that can be made of that Curtis case. You know, the Curtis case was, and where most of these issues come up is when the parties don't work and they've got a property settlement and they're dependent on the other spouse for spousal support. This, I think, creates a rather unique situation that I'm not aware has been tested in an appellate context as to if you've got employment skills and you've got ability to contribute to your income and you choose not to, is it an abuse of discretion if the court then tells you, well, then you're going to have to use some of your property settlement if that's the choice you're going to make. But you don't get to simply keep your property settlement, not work when you can work, and then use that as a basis for an award of attorney's fees or spousal maintenance. And the last thing I would say on the motion.
But the court did attribute some income to her, even though she's in school.
Minimum wage, right.
So I mean, it. It seems like the court took that, attributed income to her and basically, equated her with working 30 hours a week, which is what the statute provides.
Right, and at minimum wage, which would result in about $1,100 of imputed income. And I know Ms. DeFore made a comment about the child support shouldn't be considered because it's used for the children. Well, that's part of her budget that the court made a finding of $6,700. That includes the children's expenses. So of course you would include the child support in looking at her need for maintenance and her ability to pay attorney's fees. And I would ask that on that motion for attorney's fees, we raised some concerns about whether there were other expenses on there that were inappropriate, some district court expenses and other things. We think at most it should be a $16,000 fees based on our review of that affidavit for fees. So if you're going to award fees on the appeal, we would ask that you take a close look at are those affidavits saying the full amount that was asked for. And I see my time is up, so I will end it at that.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted. We will be issuing our decision in 90 days. As that is our last Zoom oral argument, we are adjourned.